Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, July 30th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes just one name, Jannie Henley Barris, no age given, of Longmont, Colorado. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individual listed. And now we'll turn our attention to the business section of the paper. Looks like there's three articles on that one. At the top of the page, the article is entitled, CEO of Cracker Barrel Stepping Down. This was written by Gabe Hawari and Melina Kahn. Cracker Barrel will soon have a new leader. The company announced July 27 that Julie Massino will step down as CEO and member of the board effective on August 10th. Massino will be replaced by David Deno, D-E-N-O, who is most recently the CEO of Bloomin' Brands. That's the owner of casual restaurant chains like Outback Steakhouse, Carrabba's Italian Grill, and Bonefish Grill. Massino will remain with Cracker Barrel as an advisor until October 9th, according to the company. Carl Berquist, an independent chairman of the Cracker Barrel board, said in a news release, quote, "Following a robust and thoughtful search process, we are pleased to welcome David as Cracker Barrel's next CEO. He brings decades of experience across the restaurant and retail industries, with a strong track record of leading businesses through growth and a demonstrated commitment to operational excellence, guest experience, and team member engagement," unquote. Deno said in a news release that he is, quote, "honored to lead the Cracker Barrel team and looks forward to unlocking the full potential of this remarkable brand," unquote. Now, Deno began his tenure as CEO of Bloomin' Brands back in 2019. He had previously served as the company's executive vice president and chief financial officer from 2012 to 2019. The departure of Massino as CEO follows an attempt to rebrand the chain, which sparked controversy last summer. On August 19, 2025, Cracker Barrel unveiled a new, simplified logo. While still featuring the company's classic gold and brown color palette, it removed the man seated next to a wooden barrel. Some customers decried the logo change as uninviting. On August 26, Cracker Barrel said it would drop the new logo and return to the old-timer. During its quarterly financial results call with investors on December 9th, Massino acknowledged the chain had a difficult few months. She said, quote, "While many of our guests are enjoying our improved food and guest experience, we certainly have more work to do," unquote. And that was CEO of Cracker Barrel stepping down. The second article from the business page, World Cup Breaks Help Lift Coca-Cola, written by Alexander Morrow and Juveria Tabassum from the Reuters News Group. While fans complained about World Cup hydration breaks slowing the pace of the games, top sponsor Coca-Cola was pleased with the boost they provided to its energy drink sales that drove strong quarterly results and a raise in annual targets. The hydration breaks that split the matches into four segments created additional advertising opportunities for brands and lined the pockets of broadcasters like Fox. CFO John Murphy told Reuters in an interview, quote, "I'm not sure whether these hydration breaks are going to be a permanent feature of the soccer world, but we are not unhappy with them in the World Cup." He noted a particular boost for the company's Powerade brand. Increased consumption during the World Cup added to the momentum for Coca-Cola's trademark beverages and zero-sugar sodas that have enjoyed resilient demand despite a broader softening in spending on non-essential items, particularly from the lower-income consumers in the United States. The beverage giant's second quarter comparable revenue rose about 6% to $13.37 billion. The estimate was going to be $13.16 billion, so they beat it. And that's according to the data compiled by LSEG. But the most important thing would be how much of the World Cup, whether it was the hydration breaks or otherwise, would drive a sustainable increase in demand, rather than it being a one-time bump, according to Kevin Grundy, who's an analyst at BNP Paribas. The company reported a broadly positive quarterly performance, with volume and margin growth offset by higher input cost. Murphy said aluminum and PET costs this year increased more than Coca-Cola had anticipated. Those costs were sparked by the war in Iran that has disrupted energy supplies and spiked fuel prices. Coca-Cola said in April, while it was working with its bottling partners to mitigate the impact, it had also locked in some lower prices from before the disruption, which began in February. But cost may still rise as that conflict drags on. Several companies have warned of input cost or inflation in the second half of the year, and that includes PepsiCo. Now, Coca-Cola's Murphy said the company would have more to say on expectations around these costs for 2027 in the month of October. Coca-Cola's shares have risen about 20% so far this year and have outperformed rival PepsiCo, which has suffered from weak snacking demand in the United States in recent quarters. Coca-Cola has previously raised prices and offered smaller pack sizes, as well as invested in some beverages in its portfolio, including ready-to-drink teas as well as milk products from its Fairlife brand, and that boosted revenue. On an adjusted basis, Coca-Cola's second quarter operating margin grew from 34.7% to 35.6% this year. And that was World Cup Breaks Help Lift Coca-Cola. The third article from the business page, Insurers Rethinking El Niño Assumptions. This was written by Niket Nishant, Ashita Shivaprasad, and Manya Saini, all for Reuters. For insurers, the periodic El Niño climate phenomenon has traditionally lowered the risk of costly Atlantic hurricanes. But decades of population growth along coastal areas and rising property values are forcing them to rethink that assumption. Marked by warmer than average sea surface temperatures in parts of the Pacific Ocean, El Niño typically suppresses Atlantic hurricanes by creating atmospheric conditions that make it harder for storms to form. U.S. government scientists said that El Niño arrived in June, which was also the start of the Atlantic hurricane season. They expect a below-average season in 2026 of just 8 to 14 named storms and 1 to 3 major hurricanes. Now, while historically that would be good news for property insurers, which in recent years have faced an average of $30 billion in insured losses each season, that is less and less the case, according to insurance brokers and catastrophe modelers and analysts, because decades of development along U.S. coastlines have dramatically increased the amount of property that is exposed to hurricanes, with the population of coastal counties rising by more than 40 million people since 1970, according to federal data. Combined with higher home values and reconstruction costs, both of which have risen more than 60% over the past decade, That coastal expansion means that even a relatively quiet hurricane season can produce severe losses. So as a result, insurers are rethinking how they assess and price catastrophe risk, focusing less on the number of storms and more on where they make landfall and the value of property in their path. Kimberly Roberts, who is the advisory leader of the North American Peril at reinsurance broker Guy Carpenter, Kimberly said, quote, "All it takes is one landfalling hurricane to create an insured loss of a magnitude that we have never seen before. And that could absolutely happen in an El Nino year," unquote. A hurricane season generates, on average, 14 named storms, including 7 hurricanes, of which 3 are major. That's according to government data. And the annual insured losses average around $30 billion, and that was for the years between 2016 and 2024. Insured losses across El Nino cycles, which occur every 2 to 7 years, are not directly comparable because the phenomenon has no set calendar period. It lasts anywhere from 9 to 15 months. But since 1950, El Nino cycles have on average produced about 2 fewer named storms, according to Jeffrey Strong, who is a senior scientist for tropical cyclone modeling at the insurance data firm Verisk. But these numbers mask the true risk. The 1992 season, which came on the tail end of the 1999 El Nino, for example, it generated roughly half the average number of storms and hurricanes. But among them was Hurricane Andrew, one of the strongest storms ever to hit the United States, making landfall in South Florida and again in Louisiana. Andrew alone was so devastating that it would cost the insurance nearly $100 billion if it struck today, according to the Swiss Re Institute. In contrast, that record season of 2020, a non-El Nino year with 30 named storms and 14 hurricanes and 7 major hurricanes, they only generated around $30 billion of insurance losses. And that's mostly because they did not hit populous areas. Today, a major hurricane strike on Miami or Tampa, Florida, or on Houston, which are all dense, high-value metropolitan areas, it could cause insured losses exceeding $100 billion, according to a report in July from the catastrophe risk modeling firm Karen Clark & Company. In their report, they wrote, quote, "Hurricanes are like real estate. The 3 most important things are location, location, location," unquote. El Nino is also associated with above-average rainfall across parts of the southern United States, which increase the likelihoods of flooding, landslides, and related damage, which is an adjacent risk that insurers also have to increasingly consider. Monica Ninjan, who is CEO of Property and Casualty Reinsurance U.S., said, quote, "We're seeing higher insured values, more concentration in coastal areas, and more complex supply chains. That means the severity of a single event today can be materially higher than what we saw even a decade ago," unquote. But El Nino is only one piece of an increasingly complex climate puzzle for catastrophe risk insurers. While hurricanes were once their chief catastrophe risk, climate change is increasing flooding and wildfires, in turn making risk modeling even more intricate and challenging. Steve Bowen, chief science officer at the reinsurance broker Gallagher, said, quote, "History has a limit in terms of how much it can teach us," unquote. He noted that the changing weather patterns could be reducing the predictive value of risk models. Insurers are responding by developing increasingly sophisticated catastrophe models that combine seasonal climate signals with property-level exposure data to estimate the range of financial losses that they could face from natural disasters. Some risk experts say that insurers should also focus more on longer-term trends that are reshaping catastrophe risk, like the rising cost of reconstructing properties and the shifting cost of capital needed to absorb the losses. The industry is also embracing artificial intelligence to improve the risk models. AI can help insurers analyze larger volumes of weather and exposure data, said Myra Thomas, who's an analyst at eMarketer. She noted, however, it can only go so far. And that was the article, Insurers Rethinking El Niño Assumptions. We're coming up on 16 minutes past the hour. We've finished up with the business section. It's time to move on to sports. On the front page of the sports section, at the top of the page, there's a picture of three Diamondbacks high-fiving each other out in the outfield. And it's marked, the title underneath the picture is Crisis Averted. And it's written by Nick Pecoro from Pittsburgh. The Diamondbacks managed to avoid what probably would have been their worst loss of the season and turned it into what one player said was his favorite win. In the process, however, they watched their closer struggle once again, and they now face questions about how to proceed in the ninth inning. Despite blowing a 6-run lead in the eighth and ninth innings, the Diamondbacks managed to win anyway. They beat the Pittsburgh Pirates 8-7 in 12 innings on Tuesday night, July 28th. But rather than prevailing in a true victory, it felt far more like the Diamondbacks avoiding a soul-crushing loss. As play entered the bottom of the eighth inning, the Diamondbacks led 6-0, thanks in large part to another strong outing from the right-hander Brandon Pfaadt. But the Pirates scored three times in the eighth inning off reliever Ryan Thompson, and then added three more in the ninth inning off of their closer, Paul Sewald. He served up a 2-run homer to Brandon Lowe and a game-tying solo shot to Brian Reynolds. Sewald said, "I'm just thankful guys pitched great after I left, and we managed to score a couple runs, and we won. That's the most important thing." Manager Torey Lovullo was noncommittal when pressed about whether he would go to Sewald again in a save situation. Lovullo said, quote, "I haven't thought anything about tomorrow. I have to get through right now. If there is something that will happen, I'll make sure that I talk to the right people first." Now, reading between the lines, Lovullo might have wanted to tell Sewald about the change before he told reporters. Then again, Lovullo has never had a quick hook with closers, and over the years he has left several relievers in that role despite watching them struggle, at least as much as Sewald has recently. That's not to say he wouldn't be justified to make a change. Though it was only Sewald's third blown save in 27 chances this season, he has given up 13 earned runs in 11 1/3 innings over the past 6 weeks. Lovullo said, quote, "I think the reality of it is he has saved 24 games. I think I said that last time we were in this situation. If you gave me 24 of 26 and now 24 of 27 at the start of the year, I would take that. But we've got to win baseball games. And if there are any things that need to happen, we will make that happen. But for right now, I just want to enjoy this game," unquote. Now, the Diamondbacks also have some appealing alternatives. Right-hander Juan Murillo has been Lavulo's most trusted late-inning arm, the reliever he has gone to in the biggest spots before the ninth inning, and he has the kind of power stuff that would profile well in the closer's role. As recently as mid-June, Sewald was enjoying a dominant resurgent season. On June 19th, he had logged a 3.18 ERA with 32 strikeouts in 28 and a third innings, with just one blown save in 19 chances. But things have taken a turn since then. Sewald said, quote, "It's location. It's stuff. It's every time I go out, it's just a struggle. I'm just going to keep working, trying to keep going, keep trying to get better, keep doing it. I've just been really bad," unquote. Lavulo said, quote, "Maybe some misses with a fastball. He's a four rise guy, and I think there's just a little bit less rise than we've seen early in the year. He's going to work hard to figure it out," unquote. Now, Brandon Pfaadt gave up 6 hits, walked 1, and struck out 4 in 7 scoreless innings. He has now made 6 starts since rejoining the rotation in late June. He's logging in a 1.85 ERA in 34 innings with 4 walks and 18 strikeouts. In the 8th inning, Thompson had a runner on first and 2 outs before giving up 4 consecutive hits, a double, and 3 singles, which allowed 3 runs to score. Sewald allowed a double and then the back-to-back homers to the first 3 batters that he faced in the 9th inning. The Diamondbacks scored a run in the top of the 10th, but the Pirates answered with one of their own, and neither team scored in the 11th. Jorge Barroza led off the 10th inning with a sacrifice bunt, moving Tyler Locklear to third. James McCann followed by lining a clean single into right field to put the Diamondbacks in front. Reliever Gerardo Carrillo, who had already worked a scoreless 11th inning, retired the side in order in the 12th inning to nail down the win. McCann said, quote, "It would have been very easy for us, a team, to kind of fold and say, hey, we'll try and get them tomorrow. But that's not what we did. We had some huge pitches from guys coming out of the pen, big at-bats up and down the lineup, guys getting bunts down, guys getting runners over, guys getting runners in, guys picking each other up when someone didn't get the job done. For me, it was my favorite win of the year for how much the momentum got out of our favor, and we still hung in there and found a way to win," unquote. After a tough turn through the rotation for the Diamondbacks' pair of rookie starters, lefties Mitch Bratt and Cole Drake have areas of focus as they prepare for their upcoming starts in Cleveland this weekend. Bratt wants to lock in on the command of his 4-seam fastball after he walked 5 last weekend in Washington, D.C. He believes it was the most walks he has issued in a game in his life. He said, quote, "The command has gotten away a little bit. It's kind of an identity thing a little bit. I think I have to get back to what I was in AAA last year, just trusting my stuff. The big leagues, I think, can get amplified a little bit. It is a bigger stage, bigger everything, which is true, but as long as I play my game and throw more strikes like I always have, I think I'll be just fine," unquote. In 13 starts with AAA Reno this season, Bratt issued just 2.4 walks per 9 innings. And as for Drake, well, he was experimenting on Tuesday, July 28th, with pitching coach Brian Kaplan on a new grip for his slider, a pitch that Kaplan thinks would give him a needed weapon against left-handed hitters. Drake gave up 4 runs in 4-plus innings on Sunday, July 26th, serving up homers to the left-handed hitting James Wood and C.J. Abrams. Drake said, quote, "We're going to mess around with the grip and kind of go from there. It'll be kind of a simple change, a simple feel, really," unquote. Manager Torey Lavulo said he did not sleep well on Monday night, July 27th, after his team blew a 2-0 lead to the Pittsburgh Pirates to lose 3-2 at PNC Park. The biggest reason for that seemed to be his decision to let right-hander Jonathan Lasaga pitch to the Pirates' Brian Reynolds in the 8th inning with the light-hitting Jared Triola on deck, Reynolds ripped an RBI double into right center field to bring home the tying run. Lavulo said, quote, "The Reynolds at-bat in the eighth inning is still one that is eating at me. Learn from it. Next time, maybe take the responsibility away from the players to execute and pass it off to the next hitter," unquote. Lavulo said after the game he did not want to put the go-ahead run on base, fearful that a ball down the line or into the gap would score two runs instead of just one. And that was the article entitled, Crisis Averted. Our next article from the front page of the sports section was written by Theo Mackey, all about football. It's entitled, A Mixed Day for Harrison. It looked, as the ball arrived, like a perfect manifestation of Marvin Harrison Jr.'s role in this new Arizona Cardinals offense. He lined up out wide as the X receiver. He ran a deep, in-breaking route, the type of role in which he was underutilized by previous offensive coordinator Drew Petzing. As he came out of his break, he was wide open over the middle of the field, having separated from cornerback Max Melton. And then the ball clattered off his fans' hands and fell incomplete. These are the types of moments that have marred Harrison's NFL career. Every time he puts together a positive stretch, it seems as if there's a hurdle, whether it be a series of drops or a minor injury that comes along. In that sense, practice on Tuesday, July 28th felt like a microcosm, because outside of that drop, it was a positive day for Harrison. He caught all three of his other targets, each on intermediate in-breaking routes, and with the Cardinals making heavy use of three tight end sets, he was typically the lone receiver on the field in those looks. But at the end of the day, it was Wilson who came out looking better as he hauled in another impressive catch, while Harrison suffered an ugly drop. The Cardinals have a few entrenched starters in their secondary. Budda Baker is, of course, a starter at safety. Will Johnson is the clear lead candidate for one outside cornerback spot. Sean Murphy Bunting is the nickel until Garrett Williams returns. But the other two starting spots are up for grabs as the team enters its second week of training camp. Denzel Burke might be the slight favorite for the other outside cornerback slot, but he and Max Melton have mostly alternated series with the first team for the defense. At times, the two of them have even shared the field, with Johnson stepping aside. For now, Starling Thomas V looks like the fourth option as he reacclimates to full-speed practices after missing last season with a torn ACL. And the picture is no clearer at safety next to Baker. Free agent signing Andrew Wingard saw the first snaps over Dadrian Taylor Demerson, but Taylor Demerson then swapped in, with the two rotating as they have for most of the camp. Those two battles will be worth watching for the rest of preseason. There has been a surprise inclusion in second-team offensive line early in training camp, as seventh-round rookie offensive tackle Jaden Williams has worked with that group each day. Right now, Williams looks like the Cardinals' fourth offensive tackle of choice, behind Paris Johnson Jr., Elijah Wilkinson, and Josh Fryer. That may not provide an immediate path to playing time, but it suggests that he has impressed the coaching staff, giving himself a good chance to make the roster as a seventh-round pick. The only other rookies who have primarily worked with the first or second team are Jeremiah Love and Chase Besantis, which were the Cardinals' top two draft picks this spring. And that was the article, A Mixed Day for Harrison. Our third article from the front page of the sports section, Benjamin Franklin has unfinished business. This article was written by Richard Obert for the Arizona Republic. A picture of eager Round Valley's 3A championship ring hangs in the Benjamin Franklin football locker room in Queen Creek, above the clock that is counting down the days until the Week 1 opener on August 21st at El Mirage Dysart. The Chargers from Queen Creek don't open against Round Valley, but the picture serves as a reminder of last year's final when they lost their only game of the season to the Round Valley Elks 13-10 after missing a field goal with 2 seconds left. Coach Danny Norris said, ahead of his team's first practice in helmets on July 27th, quote, "This is a motivated group, an inspired group, and a group that wants to make sure we finish the job this year," unquote. Now, when the Chargers went 1-9 in the year 2022, playing their last season in 4A, this senior group could have found other places to play in the Southeast Valley to start their high school careers. But they chose the charter school, beginning a new chapter in 3A, and they have been a big part of the program's resurrection, going 7-4 one season, then 11-2 the next season, and then 13-1 this past season. Quarterback Gavin Weiler, the point guard on the basketball team, was identified early in his prep career as a leader, a tough 5'9" kid whom Norris calls Nails. He has thrown for 4,710 yards with 57 touchdowns, almost all of those numbers coming in the past two seasons. But the losses that ended each of the past two seasons when the Chargers were the number one playoff seed have stung. They lost to eventual state champion Tucson Pouche Ridge 24-13 in the 2024 semifinals. And then the Round Valley defeat turned up the heat and is their primary rallying point. Weiler said, quote, "That game has been our motivational wake-up call, why we are working so hard. It's kind of cool to see these guys. I've been to school with them for a long time. I've been playing since junior high with most of these guys. It's cool to see us all together. It's cool to see a team bonding," unquote. With the sideline devastated after the missed field goal against Round Valley, it was Weiler who greeted the kicker with a hug. Norris said, quote, "In that moment, when he felt all of the emotions where it could have been difficult for him, he wanted to embrace his teammate and say, 'I love you, I care about you, and I'm here for you,'" unquote. Well, the past 2 years, ending in playoff heartbreak, have not been easy for Weiler. He puts a lot on himself. So Norris had Weiler address the entire program at camp 2 weeks ago at Prescott Valley Bradshaw Mountain. Norris said, quote, "The word he had for the program this year was earn it. Everything we do, we're going to earn it. We're going to go up after it. Everything we put forth in front of us, we're going to be able to take down," unquote. This is a veteran group that will miss all. Everything, Talon Spear, an All-State wide receiver and safety, who had 67 catches for 1,336 yards and 16 touchdowns last season. But senior Christian Sorensen returns after he caught 24 passes for 378 yards and 3 TDs, which included 7 catches for 85 yards in the Round Valley Championship loss. Sorensen mainly made his mark at outside linebacker last year, but he knows he will need to make up a lot of the offense lost with Spears' graduation. Sorensen said, quote, "Having Gavin back helps a lot. He is for sure the best. Me and him being able to connect again, and we already know what it's like to lose that championship game. No one wants to repeat that. I know what it's like to go all the way to play in that championship game and to make plays in that game and to also lose in that game and feel that," unquote. Senior edge rusher Jacob Falls, a 6'1", 205-pound transfer from 6A Gilbert Higley, could be the X factor for a team playing with the mantra, "finish the job." Falls, who went to Benjamin Franklin's grade school, said he made the move for family reasons and hopes to gain a hardship from the Arizona Interscholastic Association that will allow him to play a full season. Falls had 21 tackles, 3 for losses, and 2 fumble recoveries on a 7-5 Higley team last year. Falls said, quote, "I feel like I can make an impact. I grew up with almost all of them. It's very close to home for me," unquote. Norris believes that Round Valley might be the favorite after graduating only 7 seniors and returning running back, defensive back Bodie Crick and quarterback Cage Finch. But Norris loves his seniors, and he knows how determined they are to leave on top. Norris said, quote, "We didn't do what we set out to do the last 2 years. This senior class is the first group I had as freshman. This is an important group to what we've built, the foundation for what we've done the day we stepped on campus," unquote. And that was the article, "Benjamin Franklin Has Unfinished Business." Okay, I think we have time for the last article from the front page of the sports section. Number 4, it's all about golf. Reflecting on Women's British Open History by Beth Ann Nichols for Golf Week. Laura Davies received 2 candlestick holders and £9,000 when she won the 1986 Women's British Open. Only the Ladies Golf Union back then did not offer a replica trophy. So Davies' mother and stepfather had one made for her birthday. 62-year-old Davies said by phone of the prized silver candle holder she kindly polished up for a picture, "They're within touching distance as we speak." British golf writer Louine Mayer recalled a 22-year-old Davies walking into a crammed clubhouse at Birkdale after her 4-stroke victory in search of a phone. Mayer said, quote, "She got into her car and dashed down the road to one of those red call boxes and rang her mother before the prize giving, if I recall," unquote. The Women's British Open was 10 years old at that point and had already been on the verge of collapse after failing to find a sponsor in 1983. But Davies' victory marked a turning point for the once vulnerable event. This year, at Royal Lytham and St. Anne's, the championship celebrates its 50th anniversary. While the Women's British has carried the prestige of a major since the year 2001, the feel of the event, from staging to prize funds to venue, it has reached unprecedented heights since the R&A took control in 2017 and brought AIG on as title sponsor 2 years later. When England's Georgia Hall won at Royal Lytham in 2018, the purse was $3.25 million. It has since more than tripled to $10 million. That is, of course, light years from the first edition back in 1976, when 2 pros, Vivian Saunders and Gwen Brandon, put up part of the prize fund of £500 to help turn the British ladies' stroke play into an event for professionals. England's Jenny Lee Smith, who won the inaugural event while still an amateur, said, quote, "It was very much like most of the amateur events that I had played in. I think there were only 6 pros playing. There were no leaderboards, no scores. The Fulford Ladies Club members pulled our trolleys," unquote. An official program from the event notes that there were 5 pros in that first edition, and England's Saunders, who got her money back, won the second edition in 1977. The British pantyhose maker, Pretty Polly, was the event's first title sponsor from 1979 to 1982. After the tournament was canceled in 1983, Hitachi came to the rescue, and the Tokyo conglomerate was rewarded with an 11-stroke victory by Japanese star Aiko Okamoto, who would eventually be inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. Another eventual Hall of Famer, Betsy King, won the 1985 edition. And then, after Davies delighted the home crowd, Weetabix came on board, marking the beginning of a long and stable run. Patty Sheehan isn't sure how the idea of her playing in the British Open came about in 1992, but after winning the U.S. Women's Open, she was about sixth on the alternate list to play at Woburn. She got into the field a week prior to the event. She arrived in England with no clubs and no suitcase. She bought replacements for everything and borrowed the assistant pro's clubs, which were four swing weights heavier, for the practice rounds. Sheehan's clubs enclosed just in time for the first round. She went on to win by 3 strokes. She said, quote, "It was the first and only time that a person has won the U.S. Women's Open and the British Open in the same year. I think that's the only record I hold." In 1994, the event became part of the LPGA schedule, and Kerry Webb won the first of 3 British Open titles in 1995 by 6 strokes. The only other player to win 3 British Open titles is Wisconsin's Sherry Steinauer, who went back-to-back in 1998 and 1999, and then won again in 2006 at Lytham. The first time at Lytham, Steinauer walked the golf course backward so that she could get a better view of all the bunkers, a tactic that she had read about somewhere. Steinauer, for the record, did not go in a single fairway bunker in 1998. The weather was so horrendous that week that she won it despite an opening 9 over 81. She recalled and said, quote, "I was staying at a hotel that was right on the water, and there was a little executive course across the way, and I would look out to see what they were doing out there. They were walking sideways into the rain. The flags were almost hitting the round. I thought, gosh, this is going to be crazy," unquote. But Steinauer's run at the British was so charmed, in fact, that after she won her first title, her hotel bill was mysteriously paid for the next 4 years. In 2001, Sirai Pak won the first British Open that was designated a major championship. That move came after the Des Mauriers Classic lost its title sponsor when changes were made to tobacco regulations. In 2002, the event was held outside England for the first time, with Webb winning her 3rd title at Turnberry. For Karen Supples, the British Open was the pinnacle of championship golf, the only big event she ever followed as a kid growing up in the coastal town of Deal. When Supples started the final round at Sunningdale in 2004 with an eagle followed by an albatross, the closing 64 won her the title that changed her life. Supples says, quote, "I always think that sometimes things are just meant to happen. I come from a family that's always worked really hard and always struggled to have nice things. This was the universe's way of giving my family and me a little something back. And what it did was, it turned my life around. I was able to do things for my family that I would have never done before financially, and it's given me a life after golf. I'm not sure that I would be talking about golf on TV had I not won that, a major championship," unquote. In 2007, world number one Lorena Ochoa was the first women's professional event ever staged over the old course at St. Andrews. Ochoa opened with a bogey-free, bunker-free, course record 6-under-67, and never relented, winning by 4. A current or former number one player has won all 3 editions of the Women's British Open at St. Andrews, with Stacey Lewis in 2013 and Lydia Ko in 2024 following suit. The most recent British player to win the British Open was Hall at Royal Lytham in St. Anne's back in 2018. The first Brit to win the British Girls, the British Ladies Amateur, and the Women's British Open was a 22-year-old Hall who drew impressive crowds on a flawless day in the north of England. Her father, Wayne, said at that time, quote, "We've been dreaming this since she was 7, practicing, pretending to knock in putts to win the British Open. It actually happened," unquote. Wayne, who was a plasterer, caddied for Georgia at Lytham, once sold his own golf clubs to fund his daughter's travel. A 30-year-old Hall returns this week after giving birth to son Connor back in February she hopes to channel some of Matthew's magic. But it's never been harder, however, to win at home. From 2016 to 2024, players from 9 different countries hoisted the British Open trophy. And that was the article reflecting on women's British Open history. And we're coming up on 45 minutes past the hour, and we have finished the 4 articles from the front page of the sports section, and we never got to look inside the sports section. But we're out of time, so we're going to have to go on over to the entertainment section and begin by reading today's horoscopes. If your birthday is between March 21st and April 19th, that's the sign of Aries. Here is your horoscope for today. Network, network, network. The Aquarius moon harmonizes with Mars today, bringing you the support that you need. Ask for it. For Taurus, birthdays from April 20th to May 20th, you know what you need to do. Prioritize your ambitions. For Geminis, birthdays from May 21st to June 21st, take the initiative on something that excites you today. Fresh ideas come to life when you pair them with action. For Cancer, birthdays from June 22nd through July 22nd, today is full of energy, but it may all be in your head. Is your confidence brewing in the background? For Leos, birthdays from July 23rd through August 22nd, do your relationships feel energized? Ride the momentum. Work together toward your dreams. For you fellow Virgos out there, birthdays from August 23rd through September 22nd, get to work. Productivity comes with ease when the Aquarius moon harmonizes with Mars. Focus on making tangible progress. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, inspiration and confidence align today. Take your creative ideas higher. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, transformational ideas can feel very stimulating today. Do you feel ready to shift at a foundational level? For Sagittarius, birthdates from November 22nd through December 21st, conversations can move relationships forward today. Lead the charge. What do you have to do to get off your chest? What do you have to get off your chest? For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates. Are you feeling confident in your abilities? Now that you know what you want, you can put your talents to use. For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates, expressing yourself without second-guessing, creative confidence meets clarity of vision. And finally, Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th, a clear space makes for a clear head. Does your living environment need your active attention? Freshen up your surroundings. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. Here's the first letter. Dear Abby, I moved into my apartment 4 months ago. While my sister, her son, and I were moving things in, my new next-door neighbor introduced herself. She has since become intrusive. I am an introvert. And she knocks on my door wanting everything from plastic bags to cigarettes and alcohol. Every day since I moved here, she has been asking for something. She came 6 times yesterday. I'd like to be her friend, but she takes and I give. I'm tired. Help, please. Signed, Overwhelmed in Ohio. And Abby responds, Dear Overwhelmed, a way to fix this would be to tell your neighbor the truth. Tell her you would like to be a considerate neighbor, but you are not a convenience store and do not wish to be disturbed on a daily basis. And then, when she comes around asking for cigarettes, liquor, or plastic bags, tell her you are fresh out and repeat it as necessary. If she persists, Discuss it with the management of your apartment building. The next letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my brother-in-law is currently in a relationship with a woman who was intimate with my husband many years before we married. It was a one-night thing. But now she is with my brother-in-law and is going to be at family functions. I'm afraid it's going to be awkward, and I am not comfortable. My husband is supportive of whatever I choose to do. The rest of the family has no issue with it because, of course, it's not their issue. I need advice. Signed, In a Dilemma in Pennsylvania. And Abby responds, Dear Dilemma, this is not a dilemma unless you choose to make it one. A one-night stand is not a relationship. The woman is not a cause for concern. What happened between them once many years before your marriage shouldn't be a threat to you or your relationship with your husband's family. If anyone is tasteless enough to bring it up, treat it with humor or say you don't wish to discuss it, and then act like the lady you are and be cordial. We've got another letter today. Dear Abby, I'm a 17-year-old guy and I still suck my thumb, though I do it mostly when I'm in bed. I'm going to college next year and I'm worried I might get outed by a roommate if I'm caught. Is my habit that unusual? And do you have any advice on how to stop it? It's like an addiction. Signed, Embarrassed in the West. And Abby responds, Dear Embarrassed, you are not alone in having this problem. In the past, I have heard from other adults who suck their thumbs. Comfort yourself with the thought that it is not an addiction and not all that unusual. Stress has been known to cause people to suck their thumbs. One way to discourage the habit would be to keep yourself from becoming overly tired. Another would be to coat your thumbs with a bad-tasting substance. You can search online or ask your pharmacist to recommend something. And that, coupled with the fear of being ridiculed, may do the trick. Those were our letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. There's two ways to reach her. You can go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. And now it's time to take a look at some comic strips. Our first one is Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall. There's Dagwood and Blondie sitting in their chairs reading the newspaper or the magazine. And Dagwood says, Sweetheart, have I ever apologized for commenting on your fondness for online shopping? And she says, Not that I can recall, honey. Dagwood says, Well, I am sorry, and obviously I was only teasing you. And then she says, Your belated apology is accepted. And then in the last frame, Dagwood says, Oh, that reminds me. Did you know you can order personalized golf tees in your school's colors? I think we know where that went. That was Blondie. And then in the comic strip Zits, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, Jeremy is laying on the couch looking at his phone. His dad comes in carrying a bag, and he says, So I stopped by Pipkin's on the way home. And then he turns and walks away, and as he's walking away, he says, And I noticed they have a job opening for a stock boy. And Jeremy's head pops up, and he goes, Oh, wow, really? And in the last frame, just when you think Jeremy might be interested in this, Jeremy is seen talking to his friend Pierce. Apparently, my dad is considering getting a second job. And Pierce says, I admire his generation. And that was Zits. And then in Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. First frame, Sergeant Snorkel has got his swim trunks on. He's jumping into the water. He yells, Ready or not, here I come. Splash! In the last frame, he's in the water next to Beetle, who is now soaking wet. And Sergeant Snorkel says, When I was a kid, I did cannonballs off the high dive. And Beetle says, "Eh, big surprise." And that was Beetle Bailey. And then, in Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, Dad comes in the door, looks dark out, and he says to his wife, "Sorry, I'm late. Are the kids in bed?" And she goes, "Oh, not yet." And Dad goes, "Oh, well, I'll just wait in the car." And she goes, "Coward." And that was Baby Blues. And then for Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, she's on the couch, and he's leaning over the back of the couch, and she says, "I found out who the little thief in our house is." And he says, "Oh, who is it? It isn't Nelson, is it? He can be a little scamp sometimes." And she says, "Nope, it's Muffin. Cats steal things to be like their wild ancestors, or sometimes just because they're just bored." And then Earl looks down at the cat and says, "Hey, is that my old toupee?" And that was Pickles. Well, before we go, we ought to wish happy birthday to some celebrities who might be celebrating today. Who are they? Can you believe it? Paul Anka turns 85 today. Arnold Schwarzenegger turns 79. The director Richard Linklater turns 66. The actor Lawrence Fishburne turns 65. Alton Brown, the food scientist TV personality, he turns 64. Lisa Kudrow from Friends on TV turns 63. Actress Vivica A. Fox turns 62. Actor Terry Crews turns 58. Actor Simon Baker turns 57. Director Christopher Nolan, we've been reading a lot about him recently with the film The Odyssey, he turns 56 today. And, oh my goodness, the actress Hilary Swank, she's the youngest person in this group. She turns 52 today. Congratulations and happy birthday to all of them. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, July 30th, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds. I hope you have a great day today. I hope you keep on listening. Bye for now.